Hello, and welcome to New Books in Education. I'm Trevor Matea, one of your hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Garrett Kaiser about his book, Getting Schooled, The Reeducation of an American Teacher. And Garrett, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Garrett, I was wondering if we could begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm a freelance writer, and I live in northeastern Vermont. Getting Schooled is my eighth book. I taught high school for about 15 years and then took a hiatus of about 14 and then returned for 1 year, and that's the subject of the book. I grew up in New Jersey. I've been married for 40 years. I have one adult daughter, and my wife and my daughter both work in public school systems.
Could you tell us a little bit more about how you came to write this particular book, Getting Schooled?
Sure. That year that I went back, the 2010-2011 year after a 14-year hiatus from teaching, was, to say the least, a pretty intense year for me. And it's been my habit whenever going through especially intense or interesting periods in my life to keep a journal. I kept a journal the first time I went to England, and I kept a journal throughout my wife's pregnancy, and I've kept a journal at other times. And I kept a journal during this time. And because the job that I was doing was teaching, I often had to catch up on keeping the journal because I was spending most of my time on preparation and correction. But then when I could manage it, I would note some of what I did so I could go back and reflect on it. When the year ended, I looked through the journal and I decided to write an essay, which appeared in Harper's Magazine in the September 2011 issue, and it too was called Getting Schooled, The Reeducation of an American Teacher. And then that essay we pitched for a book, and there was some interest in that project, and I was able to sign a contract and write a book. I'm sometimes asked, you know, did you go back to teaching with the intention of writing a book? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. I went back to teaching with the intention, as I explain in the book, of helping my wife transition to a better job without our household losing its health insurance. I tried actually some other things besides going back to a high school classroom, the same high school, by the way, that I taught in the first stint. And this is where I wound up. I think if someone works as a writer, then you're looking at nearly every experience as something that might find its way into a book. But I certainly didn't enter the classroom with the intention of writing a book. And in fact, I had another book under contract at the time, which was eventually published in 2012. It's my book, Privacy. And one of the first things I did after signing the teaching contract was to contact my editor for that book and say, you're going to have to either find me some money and health insurance, or you're going to have to let me take longer to finish this book, because I know enough about teaching to know that once I enter that classroom, I'm going to have virtually no time to write. And that indeed proved true. But my editor was understanding and granted me the extension on my deadline. So I didn't need a book to write. I had a book to write, but I needed other things, and I set about teaching, and that led to the writing of yet another book.
As I was reading your memoir, I was actually reading it aloud with my partner, who is a teacher and is now a principal, and the two of us couldn't believe how much you captured in our own experiences and the emotions we've had working in public schools. And this has me wondering what aspects of teaching we can generalize across time and place. For example, what kinds of people choose to become teachers?
Well, first I'll say that I'm glad you and your partner found material in the book that resonated, which, you know, for this book amounts to the best kind of review one could get, because you know the territory and your antenna are going to be higher than most in terms of finding what rings false or true. I'm not sure that my own experience, having only taught in one school and not for my entire adulthood, is sufficient to give a good answer to the question of what kinds of people become teachers. I know that the profession is very diverse and that it contains a number of people with very different backgrounds, very different skills, very different motivations. Your question makes me think of something a good friend of mine once said that I've never forgotten. He's the husband of a teacher, and he taught a little himself. And he said once to me, nobody, not even a farmer, works harder than a hard-working teacher. And there is nothing on this earth lazier than a lazy teacher. And it rang a bell, because that certainly had been what I observed. Many teachers, I think, are the first in their families to go to college. Some are the children of teachers. The best of them, I think, are motivated by a passion to impart something that they care about, to work with young people for whom they feel some kind of affinity, and sometimes by a hope that things can be better for others than they were for them, either educationally or sociologically or whatever. If you sort of isolate the people that you think are the best teachers you've ever known, at least some of them were people who struggled as students themselves, either because they found learning hard or because other things were going on in their lives that made it hard, and they have this compelling desire to make things easier for another generation, or at least for some members of that generation, than they were for themselves. The worst people are in the profession are probably people who just didn't know what else to do, who chose teaching by default. You know, I look at my own college experience, and let's say that the people on the teacher preparation track were not always the most dedicated or studious people on campus. Many of them were people who liked to party, that you didn't run into them in the library, and they took their required complement of education courses, got their certificate, and away they went. Fortunately for all of us, that's not typical of the entire profession. But it is typical of some. And it's not so much, I think, the fault of these people as a system that was created in other words, at some point in our history, the country, developed a college system in order to be a kind of factory farm, just like those that give us cheap chicken and cheap pork to give us cheap teachers and a mob of them, to see that there were always those people to fill the slots. It's interesting, sometimes in connection with my writing, I've visited some major schools and universities, and I'm always curious about, you know, where the education department is housed, if it even has one. And you can hear deans and professors talk about how important education is and how they wish their students were better educated. And yet the college doesn't even have an education department, or if it has one, it's housed in a basement somewhere. Mm-hmm. Even as people are talking about how vital education is to the nation and how very, very much they care about it.
What about for those who have never been teachers themselves, that they really only know their own professional work? Is there a difference in the way teachers receive their professional development, work independently or collaboratively, the feelings that they experience going and doing their work, whether it's their hopes or their anxieties. Do you think there's something unique about teaching that others should know?
Well, again, I just want to underscore my remarks for listeners who don't know me or my work by the disclaimer that I've taught in one school and have not taught for my whole life. So the value of my answer to this question is tentative, to say the least. I think one big difference between teaching and other professions, and there are many similarities, but one big difference is that teachers are working with minors. They're working with human beings, first of all. The product, if you want to use that term, I don't particularly like it in this context, but if one insists on it, the product is a human being. It's not a cell phone or a tractor. Mm-hmm. And not only is one working with human beings, but with human beings who are not fully formed, who are minors, and so one is in a quasi-parental role. One's going to work outside the home, one's packing a lunch, but one is engaging other human beings in a way that's similar to that of a parent, and that creates a set of unique challenges, unique delights, and certainly unique responsibilities. I think the similarities, and it's one reason I think my book is of interest and of value to people who are not teachers, is that teachers are, you know, part of the same cultural and economic milieu as other workers. And so things, trends, movements, misgivings that enter other workplaces, enter schools as well. And they affect teachers as well, which is why, you know, teachers face things like layoffs, and teachers have things like unions, just as other workers do. I think one observation that might be of interest is that I think teachers were a precursor of a contemporary phenomenon, and that is the workday that never ends, which is becoming increasingly the case for many workers, driven by technology and just driven by the business climate, the corporate control that's in place right now. But teachers are often, you know, working, it almost can seem around the clock sometimes. I always remember my father telling me, when you get a profession, get a job where you know what your hours are, where you go in at a certain time and come home at a certain time. And of course, that wasn't true for him, which is why he gave the advice, and I didn't listen to him, which is why I became a teacher. But I think that phenomenon of the workday that bleeds into the rest of one's life has become the case for many, certainly white-collar workers in the nation at present.
You reference the history, culture, and poverty of northeastern Vermont. This is where you were teaching throughout the book. What makes Lake Region High School and other rural New England high schools maybe different than those in other parts of the country?
Well, I think, again, I've only been in that school, so I can't answer with great authority. I think every school is unique in the sense that there is a particular combination of factors that went into making that school and its community, and then inform it. And, you know, to take Lake Region, the school that I taught at, as an example, there are factors that make that place distinctive. Mm-hmm. The place around the school and the school itself. And one is the agrarian environment, which has taken a big hit in the past decades, but is still present. I mean, at one time, there were more cows in Orleans County, which is where Lake Region is in Vermont, than there were people. I don't think that's the case anymore, but the farm, the agricultural dimension is still there as an influence, as a context. Francophone culture. We are close to the border of Quebec. Many of the people in the area have French surnames. There are people who are bilingual. There are kids who come to school bilingual. In the recent past, I haven't heard of this lately, but there were kids who came to school even unable to speak English. There was a big influx of counterculture people at the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, who founded communes and things like that in the area. That also continues to be an influence. The closeness to the Canadian border has helped to foster, at least in the past, a kind of culture of outlawry. During Prohibition, whiskey was struggled back and forth across the border. There's less of that now, but I think it's part of the mix. The fact that the towns are small, that the school itself is small, around 400 people, all go into defining the character of the place. And one of the factors at Lake Region, I'm not sure how to account for it, but I found it interesting, is the number of people who were students there who come back to work there, who come back to teach there. In fact, my principal at the school was one of my students the year I went back and write about in No Place But Here. And there were other former students of mine who were now teachers there. All of that needs to be put against the background that many regional differences are increasingly being erased through mass culture and media. It wouldn't take me long to get to the nearest McDonald's, even though as I'm talking to you, I'm looking out the window of my office at a dirt road that I've seen crisscrossed by moose and bear. But if I want a Big Mac, I can find one very, very quickly, and, you know, I can go on my computer and do all kinds of social networking things if I wanted to do them, which I don't. And so, you know, the thing that separates a student in northeastern Vermont from a student in the Bronx or a student elsewhere, there are certainly unique cultural, economic factors, factors of race, factors of parent employment, et cetera. But in many ways, these kids are growing up in the same culture.
Your book talks a lot about the challenges, obviously, that the teachers face. A few big ones that stuck out to me were the poverty that many students experienced, insufficient social services, parents who their work schedules didn't allow them to be involved in their children's education, or in some cases it would appear that they just really weren't interested themselves. And so I'm wondering, under these kinds of circumstances, it must be very difficult to teach. And so what can teachers reasonably hope to accomplish with their students?
Well, you have to have hope to teach, and, you know, at times the hope might seem desperate, but if you're not capable of maintaining desperate hope, you should probably do something else. I think that teachers can reasonably hope, even in the worst circumstances, and I haven't taught in the worst circumstances, so it's not my place to presume to tell teachers who are in virtual war zones what they should hope or what they can accomplish, but I do think a teacher can reasonably hope that his or her students will have more skills and more options for the future and a sense of those options than they might have at present. I think that a teacher can reasonably hope that they may be able to impart some sense of personal worth, or that they might enhance the sense of personal worth that that students have. You know, kids come into the classroom feeling often that they're not worth much. And their society sometimes fosters that sense of worthlessness. As I say in my book, there was one point where I found myself saying to my students, I think more than one point, that for students of their, people of their age, region, and class, Society expected little of them except to be mindless consumers and cannon fodder in times of war. One can reasonably hope to help young people see themselves as more than that. I think a teacher can have a reasonable hope of giving students some pleasant memories of working with their minds and in community with other people working with their minds. I mean, I think there are some experiences that we provide for students in the classroom that may not make too big an impression or seem to make too big an impression on them at present. And yet, I think some of them look back and say, why did I take such pleasure doing this or that? And the reason was that they were working with their minds and in community with other people using their minds. You know, and then finally, I think teachers can hope reasonably to bear witness to some of the challenges that their students are facing. You know, society talks a good line about the importance of schools, but from where I sit, and especially when I'm in a cynical mood, what it basically wants the schools to do is keep the kids off the street and out of the workforce and out of the way. And once the kids are there, as long as they're not setting anything on fire, we can conveniently forget about them unless we're trying to, of course, market some gizmo or gadget to them. I think teachers can take the lid off that. I think teachers can say ouch when things hurt, and I think teachers can say things that people need to hear. Everybody's got a sense of what's going on in school, even though they haven't set foot in one since they were 18. I think teachers can bear witness. You know, I think teachers sometimes feel frustration when they say, well, you know, I really feel I should do more politically. I should be more politicized to change society. But how the heck can I do that when I'm working 24/7 on my teaching? It's a good question. I don't think teachers necessarily have time to do all of the political work that people who see what they see might want to do or be able to do. But one thing they certainly can do is to bear witness. They can do it in letters to the editor. They can do it in the produce aisle of the supermarket. They can do it in op-eds. They can do it certainly when they vote. To bear witness to what some of their kids are up against, and some of their kids are up against terrible obstacles, or to use Jonathan Kozol's phrase, savage inequalities.
In your introduction, you discussed tensions between your personal life and your professional life. So you describe teaching as being a noble profession, but ultimately you pursue a career in writing. At the same time, you describe public education as an important institution for our democracy, but you end up deciding to homeschool your daughter for part of her elementary education. I was wondering, how did you weigh doing what may seem like the right thing in one context as a teacher or as a citizen with the demands that it imposed on you and your family? How do you make decisions in that intersection?
Well, you know, I think it was Carl Jung who said the big questions in life we never answer. We just struggle with them at progressively higher levels. And I think all people with any kind of conscience or intelligence are struggling with competing demands. Every working parent does. Every citizen does. Everybody is having that struggle. In my particular case, I've always believed that public education is important to democracy. Certainly my switch to a full-time writing career, I didn't see as any betrayal of that. I think that senators are important to democracy, but I have no intention of running to be one. And I taught, but it was never the thing I wanted to do most. I never made any bones about that. While I was doing it, I gave it my all. It seemed unconscionable to do otherwise, but I was glad to make the change when I could, and I never regret it, even though I also never regret the years I taught. They have blessed me in unforeseen ways. I mean, before this day is done, I probably will have had contact with at least two former students that I haven't seen in my classroom for 20, 25 years, but they're still part of my life. As far as the homeschooling goes, you know, I can almost explain that. I homeschooled my daughter for a couple of years in terms in my belief in public education with a little parable, you know. I mean, let's say you had an aunt, okay? Let's say you had an aunt and your aunt took you aside even when you were a small boy and said, you know, Trevor, one of the most beautiful things in this life is marriage, is the commitment of a man and a woman to each other. And I hope that you will have that blessing in your life, and I hope that you will be good to the person you partner with and be faithful to that person for the rest of your life. And then, you know, your aunt gets a divorce in order to avoid an abusive relationship. Is she a hypocrite?
Mm-hmm.
I would not say so. I would say that she has something she believes in, but in the particular workings out of her life, that was the choice she needed to make, and my wife and I reached a point where, for various reasons, we felt it was in our daughter's best interest to homeschool her, and no parent, in my view, is obliged, Abraham and Isaac style, to make his or her child a burnt offering for his or her political convictions. In my daughter's case, I homeschooled her with the goal of her returning to public school. We worked with the public school on her program, and in fact, she attended certain classes in the public school. And I continued to support the public school politically as a citizen by speaking up on behalf of its budgets and voting for its budgets, which I continue to do, even though my daughter no longer lives here and is, in fact, 31 years old. Other people in my community have kids in school, and so I've refused to adopt the costume of the retiree on a fixed income, which is going to go to the poorhouse if the school budget passes. And so now that my kids are safely educated, I can go in there and say we need to vote down the budget. So I remain committed to public school. But by the same token, my daughter's needs were not being met in the public school at that time, in part because of budgetary cuts and restraints. And I looked at what I was doing for other people's children and what was happening to my own child, and that was unacceptable to me. I needed to make a move, and I'm glad I did. The years I homeschooled my daughter were two of the best years of my life.
The book addresses changes made in education and kind of how they affected you, having been out of the classroom for almost 15 years. Suddenly, it seems like you were struck by new technology, a new emphasis on standardized testing. I was wondering if you could talk about these changes and how you saw them affect various stakeholders in public education. So, of course, there was you and your teaching colleagues. There were the administrators at the school, your students, their parents. I'm sure you've observed the policy debate locally and nationally. And then, of course, there's big business in creating tests and textbooks and educational goods and services. How did all of those things change in their own way during that time? Or did they?
Well, you know, I think the questions you've asked me thus far, I've tried to answer with a certain seemly humility and concreteness. So now I'm going to change course and stab at the big picture, and perhaps say some unwise things as a result. But let's give it a stab. I'm not a historian of education. But it seems to me, as far as I know, that in the past, changes in education in this country came about first because of the change in the common understanding of what schools were for. Hmm. In other words, in an agrarian society, you weren't sending kids to school to prepare them for jobs. They knew what the jobs were. They knew it from working beside their fathers and mothers in the barn and in the kitchen. But you were preparing them to be citizens. You were preparing them to be able to hold some common discourse, some business interactions. They could cipher. They could read, whatever. That changed, I think, largely to an emphasis on preparing kids, not so much for the public square as for the world of work. And then other changes occurred based on changes in the world of work and the kinds of skill sets that people needed to be gainfully employed. I believe, perhaps at the risk of putting myself among alarmists and conspiracy theorists, that we are now in the midst of a major change which has to do not with a change in what education is for, not with a change in the workplace, but with a change in our definition of the human being itself. I think we are in the midst of a cultural shift in which anthropology and psychology are on the verge of becoming branches of robotics. I think our sense of what is human, what it means to be a fully functioning human being, has become very reductive. It has become data-driven. It has become mechanistic. Let's find out what brain science can tell us about the Paris Commune of 1848. So certainly there was some kind of little neurological shuffle there that led to that revolution. And so education is increasingly driven by data and by standardized testing, which tends to, and to say all the stuff is bad and it's all, you know, the boogeyman is, of course, nonsense. There's some reason to want some common understandings among teachers and some common social understanding of what needs to be taught. There's certainly a need to see that the profession is accountable. But I think that in some ways, if you look at what we're emphasizing in terms of technology and in terms of data gathering and in terms of testing, and what kind of human being we are trying to produce, I mean, it raises some questions that I think we should be concerned with. Are we trying to equip the next generation's Martin Luther King, the next generation's Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or are we trying to create the next generation's Mark Zuckerberg? Mm-hmm. What is our goal? And even if it's the latter, it's kind of amusing, since even the giants of the digital revolution were prepared by an educational system that we now disparage in the name of the digital revolution. In other words, we're different people now. We don't need all that stuff like literature and social studies, which seem to have dropped out of the common core. We don't need that stuff. We just need people like Jobs and Gates and Zuckerberg. Well, where did they come from? They certainly didn't come from an educational system that asked them to do nothing more than take tests on computers. So, yes, changes in technology, and lest I be too simplistic here, you know, there have been changes in focusing on technology that have been very positive in the classroom, that have been very liberating for certain students who in the past would have been marginalized because of certain learning issues. Just even something as simple as fine motor control, being able to hold a pencil and write legible words, these kids have now been set free by word processing, by, you know, the use of computers. Little libraries that, you know, couldn't afford books now maybe have a wider range of resources because of the internet. So, you know, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. But these changes, I think, are of concern, not so much because of the way they're changing schools as because of the way they're based on changes and how we're looking at what does it mean to be human. Wendell Berry has a book that's titled "What Are People For?" I think a question worth asking.
In your description of the changes as in technology as you see it, it seems like administrators, policymakers, those who are profiting in some ways from schools are all kind of coming to similar conclusions. Would you say that students and parents are kind of on board with this shift as well? Or are they, rather than advocating for this kind of change, are they being changed by the people that control the system?
Well, I think the answer is complicated. You know, healthy parents with their heads screwed on straight, they want the best for their kids. Mm-hmm. And they are ready to recognize that they may not know what is best for their kids. They look to experts. They look to others to tell them. And so in some ways, yeah, they go on for the ride, although I think parents and students, too, are raising questions about the direction of education, about the mandates that are handed down from on high. And, you know, if our democracy is healthy, that kind of tension and conflict among all the stakeholders is a good thing, and we can hope it will move us to a better place, that all these moves or counter moves and counter moves will you know, put us on provisionally a saner foundation as far as what we do with our young. And so that's exciting. But it's a bit daunting to me to look at, you know, say the Common Core movement and realize that one of the movers and shakers are, you know, the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates. I'm not sure. I must have been asleep during the public forum in which the people of the United States decided that the people best able to determine what their children needed were the CEOs of digital firms. So I don't know. That's somewhat of a mess of an answer. Sure. I guess, you know, parents and students, I think, are certainly not marching in lockstep with everything they're told by corporate America and the politicians who serve corporate America. But by the same token, we're all susceptible to influence. And as a species, we're quite susceptible to addiction. And I think that there are certain addictions that come through the marketplace and find their way in the curriculum as well.
In the book, you describe yourself as being politically liberal, a supporter of working people, social welfare programs, a skeptic of recent military interventions overseas. I was wondering, in what ways have your experiences in schools informed your political ideology, if at all?
Well, I think they've informed it in two ways. In some ways, in two what might seem oppositional ways. First of all, teaching has radicalized my politics. I haven't described myself as a liberal for a while, even though I understand what you're saying, and it's roughly accurate. Teaching has underscored for me the inequalities that exist, even in a little community. It's underscored for me how, as one person put it, one civil rights activist put it years ago, we're giving our kids a head start. We speak of head start. We're giving our kids a head start on hitting the brick wall that awaits them when they become adults in a society that's still class-based, that's still rife with systemic racism, et cetera. And so based on what I've seen, based on the experiences of my students, teaching has radicalized my politics and using politics in the broadest sense. I mean, it was as a teacher that I think I encountered, you know, for the first time that I encountered a transgendered person was as a teacher. The first time that I think, I've probably been running into gay and lesbian people all my life without knowing it, in the closeted earlier times in which I lived, but it was in the classroom that I think I became aware, more aware than I was of sexual minorities. And, teaching has, made me more aware of the demands, of different marginalized and oppressed groups. And it certainly radicalized my politics in regard to inequality and in regard to what would be required to make the United States a democracy in every way. At the same time, and here's where the paradox comes, teaching has sobered me about the likelihood of achieving certain political objectives quickly. It's made me understand how hard it is to change certain ingrained habits and ways of thinking. I was thinking the other day of a man named Andre Trocmé. He was a Huguenot minister in a little town called Le Chambon in France during World War II. He's the subject of a fascinating book called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. And Trocmé and his fellow villagers and parishioners managed to rescue something like 5,000 Jews, many of them children, from falling into the hands of the Nazis. He's a heroic individual, an inspiring story. And Trocmé, early in his resistance, was taken in to be questioned by a Vichy policeman. And Trocmé was a minister, okay? He was a man of theology, a man of religious faith. And he came out of that experience of being questioned by the policeman, and he said, in his journal, and of course I'm giving just a rough paraphrase of what he said, prior to that experience, I had thought that there were two big forces at work in the world, and the two big forces were good and evil. No surprise there, right? That's what we would expect right. The minister to say. He said, after that interrogation, I realized there was a third force almost as potent as those two, and it was stupidity. And to stupidity, I would add two others. You know, just as physicists are discovering different forces in the universe, you know, good, evil, stupidity, don't forget laziness, and don't forget addiction. Those are powerful, powerful forces, and they put a drag on some of our best intentions. And so, teaching has given me a more radical political perspective. At the same time, it's argued for a certain patience, a certain appreciation of tragedy in human affairs. And you put that together, and I guess that's what where teaching has left me.
Could you also comment on the operations of local school boards? So for people who aren't parents themselves or haven't interacted with school boards, what is it that they should know about how these bodies typically operate? What kinds of, how do they approach problems in your experience as a parent and as a teacher?
Well, goodness. You know, again, I know about school boards only in a couple localities. I know about the school board where I taught, and I know about the school board in the town where I live. So my experiences are limited. School boards are seen as necessary to the local control of schools, and I think at their best they function as a good block in the democratic structure. Unfortunately, there are some problems with the operation of many school boards. One of them is that school board members sometimes run because they have particular axes to grind, in regard to their own children who are into school, in regard to very narrow concerns, many of them budgetary. And they often operate in what amounts to a vacuum. In other words, the community elects them to office and then leaves them, abandons them, much as children are dropped off at school and forgotten for the day. So the school board functions with very little public guidance or input, unless a person has a particular beef with a particular teacher, with a particular menu in the cafeteria, with a particular this or a particular that. The school board is trying to find its way. And I've known school board members personally, people I have a high regard for, who are quite frustrated by their isolation, by not even knowing for sure what it is the public wants, and by trying to, you know, as generalists, as people who are not educational specialists, trying to guide the workings of their local school, and then when town meeting comes, which is something we have here in Vermont, you know, people get up and take them to task. The best school board members know teachers. They know the school. They go into the school. They have some idea of what's being taught in the school. One is sometimes amazed, and in my case, aghast, at the amount of ignorance that there is in some school board members about the school they govern. And I think this is true not just of school boards, but of public education as a whole. Education is one of those subjects about which people seem to feel that they are entitled to their opinions, and of course, technically, they are entitled to their opinions, but that their opinions have validity even when they're based on no concrete research, no exploration of the thing that they have their opinions about. And this scene, everybody knows what's going on in the school. They can tell you. You know, you meet them in the supermarket, but then you ask them, have you been in the school? Have you, when was the last time you walked into the school? And unless they're a parent with a kid in the school, and sometimes even in that case, they haven't been inside the school, which I find quite amazing. You'll get a big argument from me. I'm a big person to argue with people who say, you know, what we need to do is run schools after a business model. You know, the so-called business model, whatever that means, should govern every aspect of human activity. Well, my back gets right up with that. But there is one thing that I would say about business that would be well applied to schools, and that is a business person usually wants to know what the heck is going on in the business they run, and they find that out by walking through the place of business. When I was a young man, I earned some of my money going through college and stuff by working in factories. These were the days when America still had some kind of industrial base. And I worked in these factories. And, you know, the suits would come back and walk the factory floor because they wanted to know what was being made they wanted to, you know, they'd watch me work on the machine. They wanted to know how the machine worked. People from other companies would come. People, investors would want to know what they were investing in. And yet, in some communities, you know, the school is the biggest item. Education is the biggest item on the budget. And yet people make decisions about that and never walk in the school, never sit in a class, never, you know, go see a principal and say, you know, I'm taking a day, half day off from work. I want to go and I want to sit in on first, second grade because I want to know what's going on in first, second grade. I want to meet some first graders. We would have much better schools, much better school boards, and a happier nation in general if more people just got themselves into schools to see what was going on there. And the schools, of course, have some responsibility in making people feel welcome there. I think there are schools that would just as soon make sure that nobody in the community walked through the doors. But I don't think that's good for the community, and I don't think it's good for the school.
Teachers at the particular school where you were at that particular time, they weren't allowed to give students zeros for incomplete assignments, from what I understand. Instead, they were asked to complete them during their lunchtime outside of the principal's office. Similarly, you share an anecdote of a teacher who's made multiple copies of a homework assignment and then followed a student who's consistently forgot that homework in order to make sure that he stopped forgetting it. When discussing these anecdotes and others, you seem to characterize your own teaching philosophy as being somewhat at odds with these steps or some school rhetoric about doing whatever it takes for every student to succeed. I was wondering if you could elaborate on your teaching philosophy, how it's similar or different than your politics.
Okay, goodness. That's really a combination of questions. And so I'm going to try to touch on all of them in some kind of order.
Sure.
First of all, just to clarify, teachers were allowed to give zeros at Lake Region, but what the principal was trying to discourage, and I think he was right in doing that, is kind of a knee-jerk reaction in which the teacher felt that he'd fulfilled his responsibility or she'd fulfilled her responsibility simply by giving a zero for the missing assignment. The principal said, well, what about the material that wasn't mastered without the completion of that assignment? And so the principal urged teachers to follow up with the student and try to see that assignment got in, although he did say that if the student continues to, you know, refuse to do the assignment, a zero might be in order. And that struck me as sound. And I, in fact, you know, did my best to follow that practice. It did rub a little bit against not my politics so much as some general principles. I wouldn't call myself a libertarian, although all of us have odds between you know, our politics and aspects of our character. I've always been fond of a quote by Trotsky, the great Russian revolutionary, who said, I hate disorder and destruction of any kind. You know, that characteristically, I'm very conservative in my habits, and I like order, and I like structure. And, you know, he spent part of his life, you know, leading a civil war and blowing up railroads and all the rest of it. So we all have those little tensions. I wouldn't call myself a libertarian, but I do believe very strongly in consent. Mm-hmm. And I get uncomfortable whenever schools bypass that question and say, well, you know, we're going to get these kids to learn. And some of this is driven, of course, by the standardized test, because now if the kid's refusing to learn a certain material, he's sinking the whole school in terms of the standardized test. Well, we certainly should bring some pressure to bear to see that students They are minors, by the way. They're not always acting in their best interests. We need to try to get them to see things in a better way. But I still hold that there's something sacred about consent. If I consider some of the most beautiful things that I can think of and some of the ugliest things, you know, from a helicopter, they would look the same. You know, the difference between work, which I consider one of the most beautiful things in the world, and slavery, from a helicopter might look the same. Me puttering in my tomato garden and a slave working in a cotton field might look the same from a helicopter. Rape and lovemaking might look the same from a helicopter. Someone singing for joy and someone forced to sing in a bar by a guy, by a bully, might sound the same on a podcast, but they're very, very different phenomena, and what makes them different is that there is consent in the case of the beautiful things, and there's a lack of consent in the case of the uglier things. And so, I did take some umbrage with the idea that, you know, we're not going to give students even the option of failing, even when it seems that that's the option that they have chosen. Now, you asked me, Trevor, about my philosophy of teaching, and also about, I think, about helping students and when one helps. Which should I look at first, do you think? Why don't I just go to the question you asked me about what my philosophy of teaching was? That's maybe the easiest to get out of the way. I'm fond of saying that I'm not sure I have a philosophy of teaching. I have a work ethic. And sometimes I think that phrase, educational philosophy, is used a bit absurdly. We take a 27-year-old graduating from a state commuter college with a teaching degree and say, and he sits down for an interview with a principal, and principal asks him, what's your philosophy of education? I mean, Montaigne had a philosophy of education. John Dewey had a philosophy of education. Most of us have 5 classes and 85 students. That said, I guess I venture this far for a philosophy of education that, I think teaching is what I would call incarnational. And by that I mean that as much as possible, a teacher needs to embody what he or she teaches. If you teach English, then, your passion for reading, your passion for language, your belief in the importance of language is going to be reflected in everything you do and everything you say. And if you believe in courtesy and human dignity, then that's going to be embodied in the way that you teach your classes. There's a writing platitude that you've probably heard, show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. I don't always hold with that, but I think the pedagogical version is show, don't tell. I'll stop there, and I'll stop there.
Looking back on that year when you returned to teaching, which is now more than 4 years ago, have your thoughts and feelings changed at all? And is there any change that could happen in schools that would allow you to seriously consider going back to teaching permanently?
I don't think my thoughts have changed looking back on the year. Every so often I may think of something I wish I'd done better that hadn't occurred to me before, but my overall reflections, I think have changed, and I've not changed, rather, and I'm glad of that, because many of them were positive. Especially about, you know, the beauty and the promise that are in youth, and the real dedication I found among teachers that were there, which I continue to find inspiring. I saw it as beautiful then. I see it as beautiful now. As far as if anything would have to change in school for me to go back to teaching permanently, I think the question would have to be rephrased as what would need to change in me, because I'm doing the work I wanted to do even before I entered the classroom. Because I think that I'm at my best when I'm working alone, and because I don't intend to go back to teaching either temporarily or permanently. I can tell you some things that might have made me stay longer while I was in it, which may be a roundabout way of addressing your question. I think if I had had more of an ability to have a life outside of school, if teaching had left me more time for my family, if being an English teacher had left me with more time to read literature, how's that for irony? I think that would have made me stay longer. And if the teaching assignment was constructed on a scale that allowed me to feel greater effectiveness. I mean, when you're teaching classes that last 45 minutes, with a class full of 20 kids, do the math. How many minutes attention are you giving to each kid? And then you do a week of that. I think if the school day and the school assignment had been structured in such a way that I felt I could make more of an impact than I was able to make, that would have enabled me to stay. As a footnote to that answer, I would just say that in some ways, certainly not in terms of employment, but in other ways, I am still teaching. This afternoon, I'm going to have a dialogue with a young woman who is got a book she's ready to publish, and wants to talk a little bit about the manuscript and the process. And that is going to be a teaching procedure. In 2 weeks, I'm going to be giving a lecture related to my writing, but on the music of John Coltrane, perhaps for some people who've never heard it. And that also is going to be an exercise in teaching. And I think in some of my writings, I am teaching. I'm certainly learning as I prepare, to do that teaching. And so, I like to think that in some way, I am teaching permanently, but as far as going back to the job of teaching permanently, we should never say never, I guess, but I don't foresee that happening, even if all the changes I'd like to see in schools were to occur. But I would rejoice that others called to teach would be blessed by those changes, and the kids too.
Well, Garrett, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I just wanted to ask you one more question, and that is, what's your current project? What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on several things, in a few different genres. Right at this immediate time, I'm working on an essay about disasters and about human solidarity in the face of those disasters. And there are, of course, other projects around me, but I think I'm going to stop at that. We all have our little superstitions and fears, and one of my fears is becoming a person who spends more time talking about his writing than he actually spends writing. So I tend to play the cards close to the chest when people ask me about current projects, even though I'm always gratified by the question, as I am by yours.
Well, as someone who thoroughly enjoyed your book, I look forward to reading that piece when it's published. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed being here, and thank you for your full engagement with the book.